Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Four and a half thousand years ago, people were building places where they could, apart from anything else, rely on some kind of contact with their fellow human beings. I think that's moving. That need has never gone away, and in some ways in the 21st century it's been made even more intense.
In this week's podcast, we're travelling in a landscape swirling with myths and legends, to a time when our ancestors had moved from being hunter-gatherers to farmers. And we're starting to make marks on the landscape. With colossal effort, they built the largest artificial prehistoric mound in the whole of Europe. A powerful statement that shouts, "We are here." I'm stepping out across Britain to discover 100 remarkable places that have shaped you, me, and the whole world. I'm Neil Oliver, and this is my love letter to the British Isles.
In last week's podcast, we travelled to the world's largest stone circle at Avebury. Where's the next stop on our journey?
Well, we're still in Wiltshire, at a place that's full of intrigue and unanswered questions. When the first farmers in these islands were beginning to make sense of the world, the stars, the seasons, creation, and their place within it, they built the extraordinary Neolithic mound that we call Silbury Hill. Silbury Hill, well, it's not a hill in that it's man-made, but it's big enough to count as a hill. It's 130-ish feet tall, and it covers a footprint of about 6 acres. It's huge. It's as big. It's 4,500 years old. It was built, they began construction on it about 2,500 years before the birth of Christ. These building-obsessed Neolithic farmers. And it's as big as the Egyptian pyramids that were being built at that time, although it lacks some of the architectural sophistication, you might say. It's a bit more of a primitive. It's more or less perfectly round in its shape if you viewed it from above. And it's the sort of big, gently conical shape that you would get if you kind of emptied out sand from a giant bucket, and it would develop that kind of round pyramid cone-like shape. And obviously it's covered in grass, so it looks green. But like everything else in that area, it was built by digging up chalk rubble and heaping it up. So once upon a time, it would have been white. And archaeologists have looked into its morphology and have determined that it was built a bit like a wedding cake. If you can picture that tiered, stepped structure that a traditional wedding cake has. So they must have dug out an amount of chalk rubble and laid it out in a disc shape, and then stepped in a bit and made a slightly smaller disc of rubble on top of that. And then a slightly smaller disc of rubble on top of that, until eventually they had this multiple-tiered, multiple-layered, white wedding cake structure. So you asked me what it's like to approach it. It's very close, as in it's within a few minutes' walk of West Kennet, Long Barrow, the burial chamber that we've already talked about. You can walk between the two in a matter of minutes. So it's absolutely astonishing when you see it, because no wonder people called it a hill, because it looks too big to be something that people made 4,500 years ago. It's massive. It towers over the landscape. So you're completely struck by its presence. But it does take longer to appreciate fully what you're dealing with at Silbury. The material for its construction was quarried right where the mound is. So it now sits effectively in a wide, shallow dish, much more than 6 acres in area. And that's the scoop from which the chalk rubble was smashed out and then gradually heaped up in the middle. So it's sitting in a man-made dish, which you really can't appreciate now. Too much time has elapsed, and it's all covered over with, you know, grass and soil and the rest. But the fact of the matter is, it's kind of like, if you imagine I suppose in your mind's eye, you could picture one of those radio satellite dishes, which has the wide, shallow saucer, and then rising out of the middle of it, there's that kind of cone-like structure that beams out and receives and transmits the messages. It's a bit like that, with the dish flat on its back and Silbury Hill rising up from the centre. So when it was fresh, when it was still white, it would have been a truly spectacular fixture in the landscape. And so on arrival, because most people don't know it's there, and you could drive past it and not realise what it was, or you might think it was left over from the industrial past. You know those kind of bings and spoil heaps that you get sometimes that have been left behind by mining or the extraction of rock to, you know, to make paraffin from, that kind of thing that you see dotted about the landscape. You could mistake it for something as a product of the Industrial Revolution. But in fact, it was built 4,500 years ago by farmers who you would have thought had enough to do in their busy lives without setting out to create their own mountain. But there you go.
And it's quite extraordinary that it was tiered, because if you see it now, you'd just think it was like a round Teletubbies type cone.
Yeah, it's so big, it just looks like a hill. You'd just think it was a funny looking hill. But that's just the passage of time. We know a lot more about it. People have been messing around with Silbury Hill for hundreds of years. People knew that it was man-made. People came from far and wide to burrow into it at different times, because there were various legends grew up about there being a treasure in the centre of it. You know, maybe somebody very important, like a king, had been buried there, you know, a la an Egyptian pharaoh. And they were expecting maybe to get in there and find, you know, like the treasure of Tutankhamun. And so people burrowed in at ground level, tunnels. And then there was also a shaft dropped from the very top. And folk had burrowed down right from the top, right down to the old ground surface. And what this had done, they found nothing. There never was a burial chamber or anything else inside. If anyone ever asks what's inside Silbury Hill, as far as we know, absolutely nothing.
It's just a mound.
It's just a mound. Nobody was buried there. There's no internal structure, really, beyond the fact that it is built in these as a set of circular tiers. And the fact that it had been, especially the shaft that had been dropped from the top, had destabilised the whole structure. There's a natural process that starts off in the aftermath of a shaft being dropped and then not backfilled. It causes the whole thing to collapse from the top. And so Silbury Hill was kind of falling inside itself. It was collapsing like a flan that had been left out of the oven somewhere cold. It was just gradually dropping. It's swallowing itself. And it was a major problem, and various attempts had been made to deal with it. But finally, about 10 or 15 years ago, an opportunity was taken to do it properly. And so English Heritage oversaw a project to reinforce the structure, to stop the problem in its tracks. And so the old tunnel workings and the shaft, they were all cleared out properly. And before they backfilled them and reinforced everything to give the thing back its internal structural integrity, archaeologists and others went inside. And I was there, and I got the opportunity to wander down the tunnel, one of the tunnels, right to the centre, so that you're underneath the summit. And so we were on the original ground surface, what had been ground surface when the Neolithic farmers began their massive construction project. And we were in, how would you describe it? It's like being in a space borrowed from the chalk. You know, the tunnel should never have been there. The Neolithic farmers hadn't made it. They had made a complete solid structure. And so this tunnel we were in was kind of on loan from the chalk. And the sense was of it being a debt that was shortly to be repaid. It was going to be made good. But there was a very strange sensation to be had standing underneath Silbury Hill. There's only a few places I've ever been in my life where I've had even the outside of the sensation of maybe being about to see a ghost. But I was sort of filled with childlike hope that I might catch sight of something out the corner of my eye, something from a few thousand years ago. But of course, nothing happened. But that the fact that those tunnels and that shaft was there meant that the structural engineers and archaeologists could have a proper look at it. And it was that opportunity that let us understand as much as we do, or a lot of what we do about its construction. And what was revealed was that there seemed to have been pauses. You know, for example, you build a one of these circular tiers, and then it looked as though enough time had been left by the farmers for a turf layer to form on top. So soil and maybe grass had formed over it. And then after some time had passed, the work started again, and they built another tier. So because that shaft from the top provided a kind of a slice as though through a cake, you could see the layers. And it became evident that it hadn't been a sustained building project. And there were various radiocarbon dates were obtained from organic material in the layers. And it was very difficult to assess, but there was at least the possibility that Silbury Hill had been under construction for hundreds of years. In fact, to give you a sense of how long it was going on, you might want to imagine for the fun of it that King Henry VIII, on the day of his coronation in 1509, had suggested building the Millennium Dome. And then it wasn't finished until the year 2000. That's the kind of time frame you might be talking about. So imagine that. You see, you've got people, we've talked in the past about there being places that people knew they could go and meet people, like Avebury, like Stonehenge, like the Ness of Brodgar in Orkney. Well, people were going to Silbury Hill knowing that they would never see the completion. If anyone ever had the finished picture in their head, you know, we're going to build a tall mound. Well, the vast majority of the people who took part in the process of constructing it never saw it finished. And they would know that their children, after they were too old, their children would come along and they would help build it, and they would never see it finished either. And the grandchildren would never see it finished, and the great-grandchildren would never see it finished. It was spread out potentially over such a long period that once again finishing it was never really high on anybody's agenda. What mattered was the building of Silbury Hill.
What's extraordinary is that building on that scale and in that time frame, you'd surely have imagined they'd have needed a set of written plans. How did they do it?
It does suggest that it was being handed, that the idea for what Silbury Hill should be was being handed down, you know, father to son, mother to daughter, down through the generations. And, you know, if you think about kind of biblical parallels, you know, there's obviously, there's the very Old Testament story about the Tower of Babel. You know, the people had ambitions to build a tower all the way up to heaven so that they could get up to where God was. And, you know, so they start building it and then, you know, God comes down and decides to teach them a thing or two about the realities of life. And he scatters them. While they're building the tower, they all speak the same language. So he sees that everyone speaking the same language is a bad idea because they can get up to big projects. So he comes down and he scatters them and he makes them all speak different tongues, different languages, hence Babel, you know, for something that you can't understand. But the aspiration was there to build some massive structure. And if there ever was a structure in the Holy Land a few thousand years ago that was the Tower of Babel, it would certainly have been a stepped pyramid of some kind because it's an easy structure to build. And if you want to gain height, you need to give, you can't just heap forever because it'll just slump. And by building in these rising tiers, like a stepped pyramid, like a ziggurat, it gives it a better chance of staying upright and not collapsing. And Silbury Hill has that structural integrity. But the fact that the Tower of Babel is there and all over the world people, you know, in South America, you know, the ziggurats were built by the ancient peoples there, and the Egyptians did it in Egypt. It's long been an aspiration where you've probably got someone in control, someone that's able to marshal a lot of labour, and where they want to, you know, make their mark and declare themselves important. You get guys like that and they want to build enormous structures, put their name on it. This is mine. You know, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look upon my works, you mighty, in despair. It's long been part of the ambition of powerful people to leave behind some massive evidence of their life. And that, no doubt, was part of at least the original inspiration for Silbury Hill. It's people saying, you know, we are here. It's always fascinating to me that the similarities that there are between that time and this time, that there are certain aspects of human personality, human character that seem to sustain themselves for thousands of years. Through the 20th and the 21st century, more and more people in the West were convinced of the idea that there was no grand design, there was no God, there was no meaning. The scientific method encouraged more and more people to accept that there were just natural processes, evolution, you know, that the universe was just unfolding, subject to natural laws, and it was all random. And the realization that came out of that was that we are therefore, you know, insignificant. And so that process that's been going on for a couple of centuries now, it has atomized people. And by that I mean that people have begun to feel small, just as individual insignificant dots on a pale blue dot falling through eternity, and there not being any meaning. And depending on the way your psychology works, that can be quite distressing for some scientific people. Practical, rational people can take that in their stride, maybe. And if you've got a good life and you've got a lot of things going on in your life and you're happy, you might be able to absorb that reality and keep going forward. But for other people, that sense of being atomized has brought unhappiness. What all of that suggests to me is that for different reasons, 4,500 years ago, the Neolithic farmers had begun to understand enough of what was going on that they may well have been feeling tiny in an infinite universe. And they may have been looking up at the sky and seeing the patterns repeating and getting a sense that the universe was vast and they were tiny, and that sooner or later they were going to die and be forgotten. And that some of that embarking upon these big building projects might have been an attempt to at least leave something behind that says we are here. You know, we use smartphones like hand axes to carve out spaces in the forest of the global population, you know, where we can see something that makes sense to us. You know, that's the tool that we have in our hands all the time. 4,500 years ago, they were using other tools to create sites. We still use the same words, you know? I mean, websites. We still talk about sites. 4,500 years ago, people were building places where they could, apart from anything else, rely on some kind of contact with their fellow human beings. I think that's moving. That need has never gone away, and in some ways in the 21st century it's been made even more intense.
Would this massive white mound have acted as a beacon?
It now sits like a kind of an island of the past, surrounded by, you know, modern roads, and, you know, there are towns and villages scattered through Wiltshire, and there are planes flying overhead and power lines, and, you know, there's all the rest of the infrastructure of the 21st century. But when you go to Silberhill, and because you can see West Kennet, and you know that it's that old landscape, that landscape was traversed anyway by ancient ways. You know, there's a trackway across the chalk highland. You know, there's a trackway that leads from sort of the vicinity of, say, Salisbury, all the way across to Kent, across the chalk. And it would have been, in the absence of modern roads, there would have been this way that people could see, because in that landscape, where people, or indeed animals, walk the same way over and over again, it wears away the grass and the soil, and you get these white tracks. And the appearance of those white tracks in the landscape, they may well have inspired other people to make their own carvings, like things like the Uffington White Horse and the Rude Man of Cern, the giant chalk figure.
Yeah.
You know, people may have been inspired to do that because they could see that these trackways left these permanent lines. And so places like West Kennet and Silbury would have been connected up by their proximity to the way. You know, they were visible from a way that people had to use to travel from east to west and west to east across the widest part of England. You know, so probably the first things that were in that landscape were trackways that people built almost inadvertently, just by always following the high ground to keep away from the soft, muddy ground underfoot. They would go up onto the high ground where you could keep on seeing where you were. You know, people, when they have a tendency to want to get up high so they can orientate themselves. And so the first thing probably in that landscape was this way, this white way from west to east, east to west, depending on which way you were walking. And then as once the farmers colonised and settled, you know, they built all manner of things in the vicinity of that way. And so Silbury Hill is part of a deliberately constructed landscape. You know, you don't just think about each site on its own. It all joins up. You're looking at pieces of a puzzle. Stonehenge, Avebury, Silbury Hill, West Kennet, and scores of other Neolithic sites besides. Once upon a time, they all made sense. These places were contemporary with one another. They were all there in the landscape, being modified, being augmented. Some would be busy and more popular and be seeing more action. Others maybe lying dormant. But they were all there. They were all there. And the people who were moving around that landscape understood what those man-made places were telling them.
It's a World Heritage Site, isn't it? It's been recognised for its importance.
It is. In the same way that when we talked about the Ness of Brodgar up on Orkney, off the north-east of Scotland, that sits right smack at the centre of the World Heritage Site that's known as the Heart of Neolithic Orkney. And it takes in Maze Howe, which is a burial tomb with a passage and a chamber in it. And it takes in the Ring of Brodgar, the Stones of Stennis. And there's no doubt that there was rich contact between the people who were building and using Orkney and those who came after them, who built Avebury and Stonehenge and the rest. You know, Avebury and Stonehenge are significantly younger than the Ring of Brodgar and the Stones of Stennis by centuries. And there are various hints in the way that places like Avebury and others were put together in Stonehenge, that they were the builders there were mindful of the design of Nessa Brodgar and the way in which the Ring of Brodgar and the Stones of Stennis were linked by that narrow isthmus of land. So you had this, there's this narrow finger of land up in Orkney that takes you from the Ring of Brodgar through the Nessa Brodgar out to the Stones of Stennis, and then you're back on a wider terrain away from the lochs, and there's Maes Howe, which is this burial tomb, and down amongst the Avebury there's delineated avenues of stone, pairs of stones that delineate trackways that you're supposed to walk from one place to another. And there's very good archaeological reasoning behind the suggestion that the people who built in Wiltshire were self-consciously trying to imitate the structures that had already been in use on Orkney for 400 or 500 years. So the knowledge is spreading. You know, that way of thinking, that idea of making some sort of sense out of your place in the universe by using circles, the way they built their houses at Scarabray, the way they treated their dead, the pottery they made, which was called grooved ware, because it had, you know, grooves impressed into the soft clay before it was you know, cooked hard. All of that came into being first on Orkney and then spread. Word of mouth, people liked it as an idea. It's almost as though it moved like a kind of a suite of design. A bit like people getting the first sight of IKEA. And they all fancy having the same furniture, the same tables, the same chairs. It was a bit like that. You know, what had been pioneered on Orkney, the shape of the houses, the building of circular henges, that way of, you know, having contact with the cosmos, caught on and spread south. And then by the time it's in full flower down around Stonehenge and Avebury, the people are building on old knowledge from Orkney and other places. It's the continuation of a long story.
What were the lives of the people who built Silbury Hill like?
They're farmers. So farming at that point, farming began in the Middle East. As far as we know, the oldest evidence that we find of domesticated crops and animals come out of the Middle East, Assyria, Iran, Iraq, Turkey, that part of the world. And they domesticated a kind of like wheat and barley. They were domesticated first. And when farmers moved, or the technology moved from east into the west, you know, coming in the direction of Britain, it was those kind of crops that they brought with them as seed. You know, they would have brought seed crop with them. And likewise, the animals. You know, the animals that were domesticated, probably the first animals that were domesticated were sheep. Sheep are easier to get hold of. If you've got wild sheep, wild goats, they're quite small and you can grab hold of them and, you know, force them into pens and enclosures. It's a bit trickier to go after wild bulls. The original of all cattle is the Oroch, which stood about 8 or 9 feet tall at the shoulder, very aggressive, massive horns. Did not appreciate being approached by human beings. So it presents quite a challenge. But nonetheless, by probably about 9 or 10,000 years ago, around Iran, they had domesticated cattle. So the people living in the British Isles who had adopted farming would have been growing in the main an early kind of wheat, barley, oats, and they would have been keeping pigs, sheep, cattle. It is fascinating that the domestication of animals, all of the species that could be domesticated were all domesticated by thousands of years ago. And if anybody ever tried domesticating things like African elephants or zebras or whatever, it didn't work. And those animals cannot be domesticated. All the animals that for whatever reason had traits that lent themselves to being domesticated, human beings had identified all of them. The horse, the pig, the sheep, the goat, the cow. No doubt some people came to a sticky end trying to domesticate African elephants and other species. But no, that's not going to work. and move on. And so the farmers at, in Wiltshire, around that area, that's what they were growing. So they were clearing fields. They wouldn't have necessarily been, you know, building walls around them. The fields wouldn't have been enclosed. They were open land that were giving them cereal crops from which they would make porridge, bread, basic foodstuffs that are filling, quite nutritious. And that would have been supplemented with a bit of meat, a bit of milk. They'd have continued to hunt. So as well as having domesticated animals, when the opportunity presented itself, they would have gone out and brought down wild game as and when they could. And it must have been the whole thing. The fact that places like Silbury were being constructed at all, it speaks of surplus and spare time. People aren't living from hand to mouth. It's not as if from the minute they get up in the morning until they finally collapse asleep, they have to be involved in the stuff of, you know, making food. They've got that organised to a point where they've got time, probably in the summertime, when the weather's quite good and you're waiting for the harvest, you can get on with things. And then likewise in the winter, there's downtime in the winter, where there's nothing you can do. You know, you're waiting for the ground to be soft enough and to be enough sunshine and whatever to plant. But they had surplus, so they had food to get them through the hard times, and they could think about other things. That the Neolithic is that period when, rather than the hunters, who all they seem to have done, by and large, was provide for themselves, with the advent of farming, people get the opportunity to specialise and do other things, and they embarked upon these great projects.
Would the building phases have been marked by celebrations? Has any evidence of that been discovered?
Not as such. I mean, there's evidence of life going on around these places. You know, you find the tools, you know, you find the things that were in use. But it's easy to imagine that the work was possibly all taking place in the same couple of months every year. And no doubt they marked the beginning, the coming together. And likewise, they might mark the end, and the people would separate and go back to, you know, some of them would live locally, but others would have come from further afield, maybe to take part in the latest round of construction, and there'd be farewell ceremonies, no doubt. But it's all supposition. We know that they were treating them with their dead. You know, that's something that's so old. You know, there's evidence of Neanderthal burial. You're talking about a species that died out 30,000 years ago. You know, the Neanderthals in some instances were burying their dead, treating their dead with respect, grieving, I suppose, you know, digging graves, putting the bodies in some cases covering them over with flowers. You know, we find pollen in the soil sometimes that suggests that flowers were put over the dead. Neanderthals, you know, a species that's long gone. And so our species, like the Neanderthals, have been moved to treat the dead in respectful ways. You know, they're not just seeing someone drop dead and then walk away from them. There's an anthropologist who, when asked what's the earliest sign of civilization, and the people who'd asked the question expected, you know, a piece of pottery or a house or whatever, and she said a healed femur. And when asked to elaborate on it, she said, well, if a human being breaks their long bone in their leg, it takes a couple of months maybe to knit itself back together. And during that time, the person can't move, you know, and would be dependent upon someone else caring for them, bringing them food, bringing them water for a couple of months. And so where you find skeletal evidence of a healed broken femur, it tells you that person knew someone that was prepared to care for them until their leg was healed. And she suggested that that's the beginnings of civilization. That's the beginning of people valuing one another. And I suppose by extension, coming together to build something amazing, extraordinary, like Silbury Hill or Avebury, is that it's seeing beyond yourself. You know, you're doing things that aren't just about feeding, staying warm, making babies. You're doing things that are above and beyond the call of duty. So what you're looking at in Silbury Hill and the rest is the coming of the modern world. It's still a way off in the distance, far beyond the horizon, but you know, the modern world has been kind of conjured into being, and for the first time it's within reach. It's far away, but it's coming. Placing one foot in front of the other, our ancestors walked into history. In the early Bronze Age, a much-travelled man died and was buried with full ceremony and adornment in Amesbury. This man became a time traveller, with so much to tell us when he came back to life in the 21st century. Next time, in my love letter to the British Isles, to ensure you get each new episode of this podcast as it goes live, don't forget to subscribe, write a review, and share with your friends. You can follow in my footsteps as my journey unfolds across these isles of ours by going to my podcast's Instagram account, Neil Oliver Love Letter, and seeing the places I've chosen. For further reading about these favourite destinations of mine, you could try my book. It's called The Story of the British Isles in 100 Places, and it's published by Transworld. Neil Oliver's Love Letter to the British Isles is produced by Paul Ratcliffe and Neil Oliver for Fat Belly Films. Music is by Malcolm Goldie. Additional research was carried out by Oscar, Evie, Lucian, Archie and Teddy. Finance was taken care of by Catherine and Trudy. The post-production is the work of Althorp Studios, and the graphics are by Paul Plowman. And a special thanks to the people across history who have made and continue to make these isles such an incredible place. This has been an FBF Podcasts production.